I started falling and dropping things and just couldn't work any longer. I started out using one cane and then two canes, and I went to the neurologist one day with a black eye. I had fallen so many times and had so many head injuries. He said, "You cannot use canes anymore. You're going to have some very serious head injuries if you keep doing this. You're going to have to use a walker or a wheelchair or a motorized chair." By that time, I was wearing a brace on my foot. I was having toe drag. I couldn't drive a car without hand controls because I couldn't lift my feet to use the pedals. And I went for my checkup one day, and he said, "You're getting worse and you're never going to be any better." He had me on the maximum dosage of medication, pain pills and muscle relaxants, the very maximum they can prescribe. And I was a zombie. I thought, I can do better than this.
Meet Eleanor Pendergraft.
Eleanor Pendergraft. I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina. And my birthday is November 5th, 1935. I'm 85.
I personally have never met anyone who has been kicked in the teeth, metaphorically speaking, as hard and as often as Eleanor. She's been faced with a succession of serious setbacks throughout her entire life. An abusive parent, a bum of a husband. She got fired from a job through no fault of her own and suffered a debilitating disease, which was initially misdiagnosed. And that disease rendered her virtually immobile. Her physical condition was so deteriorated, it caused her to lose her children to foster care. Yet at every turn, something inside Eleanor said, "No, I will not be kept down." Eleanor achieved a stunning reversal of her physical condition that doctors told her was not possible, and her entire life was lifted in the process. Ultimately, Eleanor went from almost complete physical debilitation to being a medal winner in the National Senior Olympics. I'm Leslie Gold. This is A Life's Story.
I did not have the happiest of childhoods. I had a very abusive dad, both verbally and physically. I never gave him the opportunity to be physically abusive with me because I stayed away from the house most of the time, as far as I could, when he was at home. And my brother did the same thing. He was physically abusive to my brother and to my mother. He took my brother into the bathroom one day and just wailed him, and my brother was screaming so loud I had to leave the house. I couldn't stand to listen to it. My mother was a very sweet, mild-mannered person that didn't know how to take up for herself. She did whatever Daddy told her to do. When he came into the house, you better look out, because you didn't know what he was going to do. He handled all the money. And when he brought his paycheck in the at pay time, he would divide it out and he would give mother so much for groceries. Daddy had whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted it. But as for the rest of the family, we had to scrub for it. Mother would put back little bits of her grocery money for whatever the children needed. I had one pair of shoes when I was growing up, as long as I could fit into them, for Sunday and daytime, and they looked pretty bad by the time I couldn't wear them anymore. Now, my mother's family was a different thing. My grandmother on my mother's side was a character. She is my role model. She had some hard punches in life, but she smiled through them with a positive attitude, and I would go and spend a couple weeks with her every summer. She, no matter what happened to her, she got back up on her feet and did what needed to be done. She had a very serious stroke. Her speech and walking were affected. She learned to talk again and learned to walk again with a smile on her face.
So now tell me about growing up and what you were interested in school and things like that.
My only athletic endeavor when I was growing up was maybe roller skating on the sidewalks around my neighborhood or walking to and from school. My choice in high school was music or phys ed, and I always picked music. I was in a very large high school. There were 256 in my graduating class, and every year they had a best girl vocalist competition where they gave a cup, inscribed your name on the cup. And my junior year, I won the best girl vocalist competition. Choral director at the high school encouraged me to major in voice when I went to college. I was president of the choir in high school, and I did a lot. There was a woman in my church. She and her husband owned the Pepsi-Cola bottling company, and she was a trustee at this little college. So she took me to visit one day and showed me around, and she paid my tuition to go to that junior college. The first year, I was a voice major. We did HMS Pinafore, and I had the voice, the soprano lead in that. I worked in the dining hall. I took too many credit hours and too many practice hours and just overdid like I have tended to do through the years, and spent a good bit of time in the infirmary, so I was not able to complete all those music courses. I graduated that spring, 1956, and we were married in July. He was a ministerial student. I had high hopes for our future. In 10 years, we had 6 children, a son and 5 daughters.
Yeah, I just want to underscore that. 6 kids in 10 years. Eleanor was also working full-time.
The only time I ever talked back to my dad was during those years. One day we were visiting, and he said, "I don't think you should have any more children." And I said, "Daddy, I'm an adult now. I have a family of my own. I have a husband. And it's none of your business how many children I have. It's up to my husband and me."
Did you have a happy marriage?
No. He was not the ministerial person that I thought he was. He started drinking. He had a girlfriend. He was not paying the bills. He called me at work one day and said, "They've turned off our electricity and I need some money." So I met him at the electric office and gave him the money to pay the bill. Got home that evening. The house was cold. There were no lights. And I said, "Did you not get the electricity turned back on?" He said, "No, I needed that money for something else." We had no heat. It was in the wintertime. And in a little while, he turned around and said, "Well, I'll see you later. I'm going to the coast." And he took off and left me and 6 children in a cold, dark house. And that was the kind of life that we had. And he kept threatening, "Maybe I should just leave." And it scared me to death to think of raising 6 children on my own. He did that too many times. And on Easter weekend, he said, "Maybe I should just leave." And I said, "Maybe you should." So the next day, he preached at this little chapel. We went to his parents for lunch and came home. And I said, "If you're going to leave, please wait till the end of the school year." And at first he agreed. And then in the afternoon, he called the children in and sat them down and told them he was leaving. He packed a bag and walked out.
When you said maybe you should, did you expect that he would, or were you bluffing?
I was not bluffing. I had just about had it by that time. I figured anything was better than the way we were living. He was also abusive to one of my daughters, physically abusive. He put whelps all over her one day. And I know that in those days when children were wearing skirts to school, the teachers probably noticed this and wondered what was going on at our house.
At that time, there was no duty to report. It was long before school officials were obligated to report signs of abuse to law enforcement or social services.
He left that day, and our son was 12 at the time. He was the oldest. They were between 2 and 12. He walked out of the house, and I didn't know where he was going. We had looked all over for him, couldn't find him. And I was ready to call the police department when he walked in. He was so upset about his dad leaving.
Eleanor's son's behavior changed drastically after Dad walked out. He refused to do anything Eleanor asked or told him to do. Eventually, he went to live with his father. And there were additional challenges with some of Eleanor's other children still living with her. One by one, it seemed like the family was unraveling. It got hard, really hard. And then Eleanor's health began to unravel, too.
The girls, my two oldest girls, had serious mental problems. One of them was abusing drugs and went into state mental hospital. She was later diagnosed as bipolar. The other one has since been diagnosed with another mental condition. She's been in and out of treatment. The three youngest girls stayed with me. I had my first episode of MS during those years, and it kept getting worse. And the doctor finally said, "You cannot take care of yourself and all those children."
Eleanor was directed to turn her three youngest daughters over to foster care. The foster care program is an imperfect program. Sometimes kids are put in wonderful homes, but sometimes not. Siblings often get split up. Children can get put in a home that isn't suitable for them or put with foster parents who are in the program for the wrong reasons, selfish reasons. Some children never even make it to a home situation and get put in a group home or an institution.
My daughter's sixth grade teacher, I sent her a note and told her what was going on. And I said, "I don't know how she might react at school, but I thought you should know." And I had a note back from her right away saying, "We have one foster daughter and a daughter of our own, and we would like Susan to come live with us." Her husband was a school principal. She was a school teacher. They lived in a nice home, nice neighborhood. And I sent a note back to her and I said, "Well, I really don't want to separate the three youngest children if I can help it." Well, a few days later, I had another note back from her saying, "I have been qualified to take three more children." So the three youngest went to their home as foster children.
When you were told that you couldn't care for your children anymore, how is it that they ended up in foster care rather than going with their father like your son did?
Well, when I told him the problem, he said, "Well, I'm not going to take them. It wouldn't be fair to my new wife."
Thankfully, Eleanor's children ended up in exactly the right foster situation. And it seems to me they were much better off than they would have been with their father.
They gave them violin lessons and dance lessons and everything you can imagine. On Christmas, she called me one day and said, "I'm going to South Carolina to the outlets to buy Christmas presents. I thought you would like to go along with me." So we went down and bought presents for all the children. We couldn't have asked for a better foster mother.
How old were you when you first started to seek out medical help for whatever was going on with you, before you knew it was MS?
Yeah, I was in my 30s, I guess.
At what point did you find out what was wrong with you was MS? And when you heard it was MS, what were your thoughts?
Well, I was misdiagnosed at that time. The neurologist they sent me to diagnosed it as myasthenia gravis. And he was not a very caring type person. What his comment was, if it were me, I'd rather go instantly.
Oh my God, what a terrible doctor.
Yes, he was. So he had mental problems of his own. But during that year, I was determined to get my strength back and to get my children back. And I bought a used bicycle and chained it to my back steps. I had moved into a one-bedroom apartment. And I was doing everything I could to get some strength back. And at the end of a year, I rode that bicycle to work. And I went back to my doctor. I said, can I now bring my children home? And she said, you can bring back one at a time.
Imagine being told by your doctor that you are better off dead than living with what you have. It was remarkable that Eleanor's answer to that was to buy a bicycle. Eleanor did bring her children back home. Things seemed okay for a while, so much so that Eleanor decided she wanted to go back to school and get her 4-year bachelor's degree.
And I had always wanted to go back and finish my college education. And I called the dean of the school that I had gone to before, which had now become a senior college, and told him the situation. I said, I've always wanted to finish my college degree. Do you have any time on Friday? And he said, I've just had a cancellation for Friday. Come on and we'll work things out. So I spent the day with him. And by the time I went back home, I had my curriculum laid out. I had an apartment. I had my financial aid and I had my children's school set up. When I went back, I couldn't go back to the music program, so I graduated with a business degree and became a trust officer for a bank. My 6 children and a son-in-law and my first grandchild were there for my graduation.
It was a proud moment for Eleanor. She got a responsible position at a bank, and things seemed to have fallen into place, finally. Then this happens.
My husband, at times, had not been very good about sending child support. And he sent me a personal check for child support one month. And I deposited in my account and wrote checks on it. And my account was overdrawn. And you don't work for a bank and have your bank account overdrawn. And they fired me.
And then a surprise of sorts from 2 of Eleanor's children.
The older daughter called me one day to tell me that she was gay. And I said, well, Brenda, that's okay. I love you. If that's your choice and what you are, that's okay with me. I still love you. But I said, if any of my children had been gay, I would have thought it was Kelly. Well, I hung up the phone, and a few minutes later, the phone rang again. And Kelly said, Mom, you were right. I am gay.
That's funny.
While she was looking for another job, a bank from Tennessee called. Now, Eleanor really had no intention of leaving North Carolina, but the bank convinced her to go. She was employed. She had her mobility back. And despite her earlier doctor telling her she'd be better off in the grave, things were on an even keel. The correct diagnosis for Eleanor was MS, multiple sclerosis. But at least for now, it was under control. For now, but not for long.
I'd been with them maybe 2 years when the MS hit again. I started falling and dropping things and just couldn't work any longer. I also had some major surgery during that time, 2 or 3 of them. I started out using 1 cane and then 2 canes. And I went to the neurologist one day with a black eye. I had fallen so many times and had so many head injuries. He said, you cannot use canes anymore. You're going to have some very serious head injuries if you keep doing this. You're going to have to use a walker or a wheelchair or a motorized chair. By that time, I was wearing a brace on my foot. I was having toe drag. I couldn't drive a car without hand controls because I couldn't lift my feet to use the pedals. And I went for my checkup one day, and he said, you're getting worse and you're never going to be any better. I said, you're wrong.
You're wrong. There's a certain power in saying, you're wrong. Eleanor had no indication from any doctor that she would improve. None told her it was even possible to improve. They doped her up on the maximum dose of medication and said there was little more that could be done. But sometimes your gut knows what your head hasn't figured out yet. Something deep inside Eleanor, probably planted there by her grandma years ago, something deep inside said, no, I can do better than this. I do not have to settle for this. I will not settle for this. And it all came out in one resolute phrase. You're wrong.
And my next door neighbor was a member of Tri-Cities Lifestyles here, a wonderful gym. And he told me about it. And I went over that day and looked around and joined that day. And I started going to the gym 6 days a week, just gradually increasing my exercise levels. The first day, I could only walk. They have an indoor track that 8 laps will make a mile on their indoor track. I could only get about a quarter of the way around the track before I had to sit down. Okay.
Quarter way around the track with your two canes?
Canes were out. I was using wheelchair or walker. I walked in on a walker, dragging my feet. They have silver sneakers classes there, and the person that was in charge of silver sneakers at that time told me later that when she saw me come in, she thought, what can we do for her?
Margaret Broyles was the silver sneakers instructor that saw Eleanor drag herself into the gym that day.
I was the aerobic coordinator at Lifestyles Fitness Center, and Eleanor came in the front door. I just happened to be at the front desk that day, and she was in a wheelchair. I taught a silver sneakers class, and it was almost time for that class to start, probably like in 20 minutes or so. And this is probably horrible to say, but my first thought was, oh my goodness, I bet she's coming to silver sneakers. How am I going to meet her needs? I had not had anyone who had not been able to walk in with at least just a walker, and she had been in a wheelchair for years. But that was my job, to meet the needs of all of them. And I was not about to let her leave class feeling defeated and not want to come back.
Eleanor found allies in that gym. Now, she looked like she didn't belong in any gym, like she would be better off in assisted living or even in a nursing home. But Margaret was intent on helping Eleanor and other folks who saw Eleanor struggle but not quit, added their own encouragement. And the encouragement of those strangers meant something to Eleanor.
When I started in the gym, I'd go 3 days a week to Silver Sneakers, and the other 3 days, I would walk the track and work the machines. And the people there were so supportive. Perfect strangers, people I'd never met before, would give me a thumbs up, or they'd come and say, you're doing great. I was on the walker on the track for a while, and then I got better and stepped down to two canes, and then I stepped down to one cane, and I saw people running on the track, and I thought, I really would love to be able to do that.
Think of how absurd that sounds. Eleanor, severely stricken with MS, in her 70s, running. I'm sure there were many people saying, what are you doing? You've come so far. You're walking. You don't need to run. You could fall. You could hurt yourself. Just keep walking.
And one day, there were not too many people in there watching. So I picked up that cane and started running. And that was the last of the canes. I was running from then on.
Margaret was there for that moment, too.
A light bulb went off. That's Eleanor. And I almost had a heart attack. And I stopped and I said, Eleanor, what are you doing on this track with canes? She said, I'm good. I can do this.
Well, after that, there was no stopping Eleanor.
We had a walking club there, and I was the first one in the gym to complete all of the miles in the walking club. I think that first year I did it, I walked 450 miles on the indoor track. A friend in Silver Sneakers who did Senior Olympics said, "You need to enter Senior Olympics." And I laughed. I said, "I've never been athletic, and I've been so disabled for 30 years now." And she said, "Try it. You'll really love it." So I looked into it, and I started entering, and I started winning medals.
Which events did you compete in?
Track and field and road racing. Started at 50 meters and went on up to 10K. About the only thing I didn't do was pole vault. I did high jump, long jump, all the races, shot put, javelin, discus, softball throw, power walk, the whole thing.
Wait, you did a 10K?
Oh, yes. Oh, my first time going to nationals was 2011 in Houston, and I won my first national medal there on one of the races. I won a bronze medal. When I came back, I done a 10K and a half marathon.
I had to know more about the Senior Olympics. Officially, they are called the National Senior Games, and Del Moon is the Director of Communications and Media.
Eleanor was, you know, completely unaware of us when she went through her challenges. And, you know, a friend walked up to her and said, "Now that you're walking, you need to get into Senior Games, Senior Olympics."
By the time she got to you, what was her physical condition? Was she ready to compete?
Oh, she had already been involved in Senior Games for a few years when I caught up with her. I guess it had been 10 years since she had determined she was going to change and fight this thing. When I met her, she was a relatively finished product, I guess you could say, that she was kind of fresh out of the oven and just like, "I'm so excited to be doing this. And it's amazing that I can keep this at bay like this."
Her story, when you first hear it, is almost unbelievable in the true sense of the word. She was almost completely debilitated, and now she's winning medals. So very few people improve to begin with, and then to do so at a relatively advanced age when she started to improve. Do you think that says something about Eleanor specifically, or does it say something about the potential in all of us, or both?
It's a little of both, but it's really about the potential in all of us. If you believe that you start to degrade and that you're going to die after you're 50 and that there's nothing left to live for and everything just kind of goes away and turns gray and all that kind of stuff, the first time you get sick, you're going to think, "Oh my God, I'm going to die." And you might die. Now, if you believe that you were built to last a long time and that you give your best effort to fight whatever challenges life brings to you, then it's a battle worth taking.
What kind of shape do you have to be in to compete in the National Senior Games? Do you really have to be almost Olympic level, or is it for all levels?
It's for all levels, especially when you get to local games and state senior games where people qualify to come to the National Senior Games. You find people of all abilities. And the great thing about it is that this is a great adult mature community. There's no high school hairy antics going on. People aren't, you know, smacking on each other, just in fun, yes. So everybody supports everybody else. And the last person across the line is usually the one that gets the most applause. So people don't look down on you for not having more ability. They say, look at you, and they say, "Good for you. You're doing what you can do."
It's an amazing group of people. And the friends that I've made from all across the country, that's the best part of going to Senior Olympics.
She gets so much support from all the other people around her, and she generates so much energy and inspiration to everyone else around her. And again, we see that a lot in Senior Games. People support each other. They're uplifted by each other.
I went to Albuquerque this last time to the Nationals, and I won my first gold medal in the Nationals in one of the races. At the Nationals, they have about 10,000 participants. And you would be amazed at the number of older people, really older people that compete. There are a couple of women over 100 that race in the National Senior Games. I have so many inspiring people to see when I go to these nationals.
How old were you when you got that gold medal you told me about?
I was 83. I still had that scooter sitting inside the entrance to my apartment. And I hung all of my medals on the wall right above that scooter just to remind me how far I had come and how much I had to be grateful for every time I walked in and out of that door.
In her case, it was a really long slog to get from where she was to where she got to be. Let's just talk about Eleanor specifically. What is it about her that would make her dig in like that for so long without any guarantee that it'll work out okay?
Honestly, I think she just got sick and tired of being sick. I think she got sick and tired of seeing other people doing regular, normal things in life, and she had to grab two canes or get her walker or ride her scooter to get there.
I asked a similar question of Margaret.
You know, Eleanor has not had an easy life overall.
No.
Right? She's had, these are my words, not hers, she's had a bum of a husband. She's had her children taken away by foster care, and then she's had additional challenges with some of her children beyond the foster care issue and, of course, her physical disability. What is it about Eleanor that prevents her from giving up or falling into a state of self-pity? She almost never feels sorry for herself.
The fact that she wants to stay out of the wheelchair and she wants people to be proud of her. She wanted her children to be proud of her. I think that has been the driving force on her being so successful, is that she wants people to be proud of her and what she has accomplished.
You talked about some of the setbacks you've had and the accidents and so forth, and the uncertainty and the unpredictability associated with MS is one of its more distressing aspects, I'm told. And I read that anxiety or depression can be common with people with MS because they can take, you know, one step forward and two steps backwards. Did you have any bouts with either anxiety or depression?
I am a person that does not like to be still. I don't like to be a couch potato. So I fought against that by keeping myself busy. I had always wanted to learn to paint. So I took one lesson in landscape painting at the senior center, and I bought a bunch of supplies and set up my easel in my living room. And while I was painting, I brought home recorded books, and I set it up right next to my easel. So I listened to recorded books while I painted, and that took my mind off of how tired I was and all of these thoughts about what bad shape I was in. And I didn't really give myself time to feel too sorry for myself.
What would your advice be for folks who have become either more sedentary or more immobile than they wish they were, whether it's from illness or not?
There's always something you can do. If it's just walking up and down the hall in the building where you live, if you can get out and walk longer distances, that's even better. But there's always some kind of exercise that you can do. If you lie in bed, you can exercise your arms or your legs if you can move them. But you don't have to just completely give up.
There are several lessons we can derive from Eleanor's incredible story. One is how the support of strangers can mean so much to somebody who is struggling. Those folks at the gym who looked at Eleanor in her state of almost complete disability and told her, "Good job, meant something to her. That's one lesson we can all take to heart. Another is what Eleanor referred to. You can always do something. And I'll add that doing something, no matter how small, beats doing nothing 100% of the time. Yet I think the larger message from Eleanor's story is the power of the human will. Dale Carnegie said, "The person who goes the farthest is generally the one willing to do and dare." That quote came to mind as I was reflecting on Eleanor's life. The human will can't be found on an anatomy chart or a map. It's not emblazoned across the sky. And yet its force is everywhere. It is the force that develops things, transforms the world, and changes people. In a way, it is the sum of everything that makes us. Eleanor had no reason at all to think she would improve, even modestly, from going to the gym in her state. Yet she went, day after day after day, willing herself to more mobility, less fatigue, and a better quality of life. When everyone that mattered said, "You aren't going to get any better, ever," Eleanor's will said, "You're wrong." And she has over 300 medals hanging off her now retired scooter to prove it. I'm Leslie Gold. Thank you for listening to A Life's Story.